First of all, I want to thank Don for putting this together. As he indicated in his introduction, we've been kicking this idea around for a long time, and it really wasn't until today that I realized it had been 12 years that we've been talking about this. And what it took was somebody who was willing to say, I'll do it, and that was Don. You know, we've been talking about it forever, and then I think it was last year at the regional project meeting in Fayetteville that you said, I'll do it if you guys will help, and we said, sure, we'll help. But I want to thank Don again for actually being the person to take leadership for putting this thing together. We really didn't have a set format for how these presentations would go, so we were all doing it kind of our own different ways. And so the approach that I'm going to take is I'm going to take a slice, a pretty big size slice. I'd say a thread, but it's more like a deep channel through Dick's career, and that's the MacRaquel and Mite story. And I'm going to talk, I'm going to go into the Wayback Machine, to some of the very early work, hit a few of the high points along the way. And then in the last part of the presentation, I'd like to talk about the lessons that I took away from my time with Dick at NC State. So let's see, before would we use the arrow buttons over here? So just to set it up, when we look at the story, or when we look at Dick's contributions to our knowledge of macroquelid mites as predators of flying immatures, you can see it covers a tremendously broad area, a tremendous number of activity areas. Starting off with field surveys to document occurrence, as Don talked about with the parasitoid work. Ecological associations, as Don talked about. He looked at predator-prey relations, movement of the mites because they don't fly, how do they get around. He looked at foracy as a mechanism for mite dispersal. Some ultrastructure work done by Lewis Coons. Some sensory biology work. The non-target effects of pesticides on the mites, and Dick was really a pioneer in this area. Nobody was doing this kind of work when Dick first started doing it. The importance of the mites as biocontrol agents and carrying it all the way through to simulation modeling. So it's a tremendous swath of work during the years that he covered this area. And it depends how you count them, but by my count, I came up with about 41 scientific publications that touched on macroquelid mites. And it's really far more than can be covered in the time we have here this afternoon. But first, I want to go back into the Wayback Machine. I realized this morning this wasn't your very first paper, Dick, but it was your second paper, I guess, the 1961 New Records of North American Macroquelidae and Their Predation Rates on the Housefly. So this was Dick's first paper on the topic of macroquelid mites. And in this paper, I guess this was your Eagle Scout project in 1961. It couldn't have been your PhD work, but it was, you know, part of Dick's PhD work. First thing he did was go out and see, well, what do we have out here in the way of these macroquelid mites? And documented the occurrence of three previously unknown species from North America. And documented not only that they were here, which he could have done and just left it at that, but brought them into the lab and did some predation rate studies with them to sort of rank them and see how they fell out with regard to their potential importance as biocontrol agents. So this is 1961. The early 60s were busy years for the macroquelid business with Dick. 1963, in another landmark study, he collected manure embedding samples from 92 farms. And Dan, you were talking about Dick's no-nonsense approach, and this is evident in his early work. I mean, he didn't just hit a few farms around the lab. You know, he went to 92 farms, he extracted and collected and identified the mites from those farms, determined, collected data on relative abundance, looked at different animal production systems, where they occurred on the farms, looked at the frequency of occurrence and the relative abundance from 79 barns. And very importantly for subsequent researchers in this field, he provided just a stunning series of plates and measurements for these mites so that for subsequent workers who are going to work in this area, we have this beautiful guide that's still just as good today as it was the year it was published. Beautiful photographs for identifying these mites, seven species of mites. 1963, there was another, Dick had another paper, and this was the first attempt to study the importance of macroquelids for fly control in the field. So in that first 1961 paper, he had done a lab study, but in 63, he wanted to document what happens under field conditions. And he took two approaches to do that. In one, he compared fly production from undisturbed calf bedding with bedding that had been treated with a miticide. And in a second set of tests, he seeded piles of manure with fly eggs with and without the macroquelid mites. And he came to the conclusion that mites were a major mortality factor for flies in the field. And there's this prescient quote from 1963 that it is likely that the currently recommended chemicals for housefly control cause considerable mite mortality. And evidently this got him thinking about non-target effects of the pesticides that were being used. But this is back when larviciding was still a fairly common practice. In 1964, he published a paper looking at forestry as a means of mite movement. And in this paper, he did presented data on field and laboratory tests on forestry by macrochelids on housefly adults. And he looked at the frequency of forestry by mite species, not just Macrochelys muscidomestici, which is the most common one, but he looked at other species, looked at mite loads and attachment sites, and made the observation that of the five common mite species that he found, only M. muscidomestici and M. sabbateus were phoretic on houseflies. And he went on to discuss how these results helped explain some of the distribution patterns of the mites in different habitats that he'd seen before in the survey work. In subsequent studies, graduate student Don Farish examined mite behavior in the laboratory, and he conducted ablation studies to determine the location of olfactory and contact and cilia on the palps and on the first tarsi in locating host flies. And these were two very nice studies on that topic. Now, in 1966, he published a paper in which he revisited the topic of the selectivity of insecticides that were being used, the non-target versus target effects of commonly used insecticides. And again, this is a classic Dick no-nonsense approach. I mean, you can see the table from the study, tremendous number of materials, wide range of doses, two hosts, a huge, huge study. And when I revisited this paper and looked at it, I thought, God, that was a lot of work. I wonder who helped. And then there in the acknowledgments is Tommy Edwards. It was the first acknowledgment that I saw of Tommy, and most of us who worked with Dick over the years knew Tommy well. So there was a tremendous, tremendously large number of materials tested and a great effort. He then went to the field and looked at integrated control, looked at the consequences of larviciding on the macrochelid mites. And he did extensive field testing in poultry houses, which confirmed that insecticide application to manure, larviciding, had both immediate and long-term effects on mite populations. And the quote from this paper was, "The larviciding of the manure with the non-selective insecticides should not be practiced." It was a very specific recommendation that came out of this work. And it also made the observation at this time that integrated control of the house fly is not yet a reality, indicating the distance that was yet to be traveled in this area. And then in 1970, he published what I would submit is probably one of the most influential papers in veterinary entomology, the 1970 paper, Integrated Fly Control Program for Cage Poultry Houses. In these two papers, he presented the results of the impact of different fly management approaches on populations of flies and of the natural enemies on poultry farms. And in the first paper, the one on the top there, he actually presented an IPM program based on conservation of natural enemies through manure management and selective use of adulticides. And in the spirit of true IPM, he came up with a management with a monitoring approach that hadn't been field tested before, and that was the spot card, which Tim will be talking about a little bit later on. But it was a true IPM program involving monitoring, selective use of insecticides, and conservation of natural enemies. And nothing like this had been seen in the animal agricultural area. As the years went by and other materials came up, this is a later paper where Dick looked at the effect of cyromazine on the natural enemies as well as on the fly. And I've been mentioning macrochelids, but there were, in addition, other predaceous mites that he studied, mites in the family Parasitidae and in the Uropodidae. And I may be forgetting others, but those are the two that come to mind. A series of papers on non-macrochelid predators of the fly. As we moved up into the mid-1980s, Dick's program began to collect data to refine our understanding of the impact of predators and parasitoids on fly populations, with the long-term goal, and not so long-term actually, with the goal of putting it all together into a model that would allow one to look at the consequences of different management decisions on fly populations. And I was fortunate enough to be able to help with that work during those years. So as a goal towards that, as a step towards that goal of having an overall model, we published the first module of that model was a standalone model of MacroAchilles muscular mastocci. And that became the nucleus that other models were tacked onto, and then of course it was taken on to a new level when Larry Wilhoit came along and rewrote the code in a different language, made the code much more elegant. And then we came out in, Dick came out in 1991 with Fly Management Simulator, or FMS. And this was really quite an achievement. This was a very comprehensive model that allows the user to examine the outcome of manipulations of such things as manure management, fly immigration and emigration rate, manure moisture, immigration, emigration, chemical control, the hardness of the chemicals on the flies relative to the natural enemies, and manipulations of the natural enemies. Are they present? Are they being released? Do they have alternate prey to feed on? Very complex model, which those of you who haven't ever explored this model, it still is available on the NC State website. And those of us who were around during those years will remember that Dick used to come to meetings every year with the discs. And in those days he was selling them, but now the model is available for free on the website. And one of the, I believe that the user's guide and the technical bulletin are no longer in print, but I've been trying to twist Wes's arm to get them. You have copies, and we'd like to see those scanned and made available so that people can not only get their hands in the model, but also in the documentation, because you really need the documentation to play with the model. But really, this model is something that anybody who's interested in fly control at all should get in and just play around with, because it's a really interesting way to look at outcomes of different manipulations of things. So as I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, this is a wide swath through the area of macroachilids. In my opinion, it's a paradigm of scholarly inquiry that spans basic biology, field ecology, behavior, and applications, all with a long-term view of solving practical problems. And to me, that's a model that we should all aspire to. It led, in terms of direct impacts, it led to the development of rearing methods for predators, some of which are now commercially available from insectaries. And it provided the foundation for future work and inspiration for other investigators, including myself. I first met Dick in 1978 at the LIWC in Wyoming. I was a master's student at the time, and I had an interest in macroachilles and carcinops, and we talked a little bit at that meeting, and he encouraged me to follow up. And those papers that I was just discussing were a real inspiration to me in that career. And then it was 1984, I had the good fortune of joining Dick's program as a postdoc. And some of us are still here in this room. Dick's right here. Tim's out there. And some of you might not know Dr. Sue. Dr. Sue, where are you? Okay, would you stand up, please? Dr. Sue has come all the way from China to be here for this event today. So, this is an old picture. I'm one of the bearded guys. Yeah. So again, I had the good fortune of joining Dick's program a long time ago. And so what I'd like to do now in the last few minutes is to go over what I've tongue-in-cheek called the Tao of Dick Axtell. But I'm not being facetious here. When I approach research problems today and over the years, I often feel Dick's presence in the room. And a lot of lessons that he taught me that I'd like to think that I've taken to heart and carried with me from that time, from his mentoring. And so one of the things I remember him saying shortly after I got there was that even a journey of 1,000 projects begins with a single experiment. That might not be an exact quote, but the idea was I'd only been there a short time, and I was supposed to be working on a nematode parasite that we were evaluating for houseflies. And he asked me how the work was going, did I have any data to report? And I said, well, no, I'm still kind of getting the kinks out of it, getting it to work. And he made the point that there's no point spinning your wheels doing preliminary experiments. The best way to learn about doing something is to do it as though it were going to be going into a publication. And that's a lesson that I like to think that I've learned, there's no point doing preliminary work. If it's worth doing, it's worth doing well. And that was an important lesson. Another thing that I think Dan Klein touched on was that Dick often emphasized that this distinction that a lot of us like to make between basic and applied research is fundamentally artificial and generally overstated, that science is science, and if there's a question worth asking, a question worth trying to answer, the scientific method is applicable, and it's not really worth arguing about whether it's applied versus basic. It's all science. Actually, I want to go back to my first few days. A lot of us have sort of first week in the job stories about Dick, and I guess I'll tell mine. I just arrived. It was January 1984, fresh from Massachusetts, and Dick gave me an assignment. And it seems like a lot of us have these challenges that Dick gave us in those early days. And so the challenge I got was I was to take the government car and drive to a feed mill in Duplin County and meet a truck that was coming in at 6 a.m. to pick up a load of chickens to bring back to the lab. And so I got to this feed mill, and they were just opening up, and all the guys that worked there were coming in for their morning coffee. And I sat there, and they were talking to me, and I didn't understand a word they were saying. And I'm not kidding. I mean, I understood the odd word here and there, but I thought, I speak English, they speak English, I can't communicate. It was really, really embarrassing, but we got the chickens somehow and made it back. Another thing that Dick often said was that there's no substitute for direct observation. Keep your experiments simple. Get as close to answering the question as directly as possible. And this led me, in a very direct example of that, to spend the night in a poultry house looking at diurnal movement of litter beetles up and down the walls of the poultry house. There was no point trying to guess at it through trapping. Better to just go there and actually watch them and make the direct observations. Another pitfall that he cautioned against often was avoiding the seductions of false precision. And that included things such as not having more significant digits than were appropriate in your standard errors, but also not having too much faith in the precision of your own experiments. And the example I have of this is I'd been working on predators, the Carcinops beetles and the macrochelid mites, and I was interested in combining them in different ratios of relative killing power. And I was trying to come up with ratios that, based on my experiments on killing power, would be even or 5x one way or the other. But I had so much faith in the precision of the experiments that I came up with what Dick termed these weird ratios. So I had 137 mites with 5 beetles. So why didn't you just round it to 150, you know? And I appreciate that now, that I was so keen on, well, no, it's 137 equals 5 beetles. A related point that he often made was that for a difference to be a difference, it has to make a difference. So when you're writing a paper, don't just say that there was a statistically significant difference between A and B. What does it mean? If it's not important, don't talk about it. Now, Tim got away with putting a lot of figures in his papers, but my experience with Dick was this statement. One table is worth 1,000 figures. Dick always preferred to see the numbers, and I do too, that nothing replaces actually seeing the numbers for the data, whereas with figures, if you want to get at the numbers for your own uses, if you want to see what happens if you fool around with the numbers, you have to draw lines across and try to convert. He always emphasized, whenever possible, to use tables to present the data. Another lesson I had to learn was that writing a scientific paper is not like writing a novel. And this came up when I was writing a paper on a long series of tests we had done on the compatibility of insecticides with disinfectants. So my results narrative was basically a constant repeating of the same words of, when this was mixed with this, this is what happened. And I was trying to be clever and Ernest Hemingway about coming up with new ways of saying that every paragraph. And Dick said, you know, this is not a novel. Just, you know, it's okay to use the same words. The objective is clarity, not cleverness in the narrative. Okay, I'm about there. Another point I had to learn was not to shoot myself in the foot in the discussion, as Dick used to put it. He said, you know, you're reading the paper and it's going along great, and then in the last three paragraphs you start talking about, well, you may think that there's a problem because of this, and oh yeah, I guess there might be. He said, you know, no need to put a spotlight on the problems. If there's something that really needs to be addressed, okay, but you don't need to draw unnecessary attention to any flaws that may be there, or any weaknesses that you may be aware of in the paper. Another point was keeping your slides simple and easy to read. When I first arrived in Dick's lab, fresh out of grad school, I'd given a few talks and I thought I knew a lot about slide preparation. But this is back in the dark ages when we made our own slides and the quality wasn't always what it was. So, you know, Dick had the audacity to have us give practice talks before the livestock meetings in 1985. And this is not an actual slide from that talk, but it was, I don't have that many of my old bad slides anymore. So this is the kind of thing that I came up with. There were a lot of things wrong with this slide. It was hard to read, too many significant digits, too much white space. The data was framed with a big margin around and unreadable, basically. And so I was stubborn. I had to learn the hard way to make my slides readable. I've gotten better. Another guideline was don't have more than one slide per minute. That's one I have not been able to follow in spite of my best efforts over the years. Oops, went the wrong way. The last point I want to make is actually something a little bit outside the scientific arena, and that is, you know, Dick and I would often talk politics, and when I first arrived in North Carolina, and it was 1984, it was a big year. Our Democratic governor, Jim Hunt, was trying to unseat the incumbent, Jesse Helms. Walter Mondale was running for president. I mean, there was a lot going on politically. And there was a local race in which I thought the Republican guy was actually okay, you know, and Dick and I were talking about that. And he explained to me that voting was very simple, that I didn't need to complicate it, because the voting machines in North Carolina at that time had a straight ticket option. It had a big lever that you could just pull for a straight ticket for all one party or the other. So Dick's recommendation when it came to voting was just pull the long lever labeled D and don't think so much about who's running in which race. So that was all back in 1985, and I like to think that these lessons have served me well over the years. And here we are a couple of years later, but we're all still here, and I just want to take this opportunity to thank Dick for his mentoring, his wise counsel, and his friendship over the years since. Thank you.